That's Tori Kelly there with Colours of the Wind. Now, one of the most influential wine writers in the world is British-born Jancis Robinson. She chats to Rita Ehrlich about the latest edition of her World Atlas of Wine and the challenges of keeping up with rapid advances in wine styles, plus the massive changes wrought upon the industry by climate change.
I'm talking with Jancis Robinson. She's a name that I recognise. She's one of the most, for me, the most highly regarded wine writer, and she's been a wine writer for a considerable time. She's written reference books, she writes a website, she writes columns, she edited the Oxford Companion to Wine, and she's also the co-author and co-editor of the World Atlas of Wine, which is now in its 8th edition. She and Hugh Johnson do that together. It's a massive tome. It's one of the most useful books for anyone who's interested in wine generally, because it gives you enough information to go searching for more if you choose. Jancis, how do you divide up the work, you and Hugh?
Who was responsible for the first four editions, including the very first one that came out in 1971? Which must have been a nightmare to prepare because there weren't the plethora of wine maps that there are today that you could at least use as reference sources. Then when he had to do the fifth one, he quailed and said, please, 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 Jancis, will you take over? So I've been primarily responsible for 5th, 6th, 7th and now out this month, 8th edition of the World Atlas of Wine. But Hugh gets involved very much with the planning of each new edition and then certainly reads all the texts with great attention and is a wonderful smith. So if you ever see a really polished sentence, that's probably one that Hugh has polished.
What are the main differences between this edition and the previous one?
Massive, massive differences because the world of wine has been changing so much and so rapidly. In fact, some poor person in the Foreign Rights Department of the publishers had to count up the number of new words and came up with, I think, 45% of the words are new. So it really is a brand new edition and a complete change from the seventh. One of the major changes of the world of wine is its shape. Because of climate change, people are planting vines ever closer to the poles. That's particularly marked in the Northern Hemisphere because there's actually room to move vineyards north, whereas there isn't much room to move vineyards south. Also, of course, people in search of cooler temperatures are planting higher and higher uphill so that they get nice cooling nights to extend the growing season. And then I suppose there's been a great change in fashion in what is regarded as good quality wine. So it's no longer the case that everyone is trying to make big, alcoholic, deep-coloured, oaky wines. They're looking for much more freshness. And I'm delighted to say, more geographical expression. Wine has always been geography in a bottle, if you like. It expresses the place on the earth that's responsible for it. And nowadays, people are making wines with smaller and smaller geographical units on the label, like, you know, the increase in single vineyard wines, for instance.
That's always been the case in France, where there's been such interest in the expression of terroir, as they say. But I think it's true in more and more places.
Absolutely. I mean, even Australia, you're seeing far more single vineyard wines, I would say. And I think that's great. When I started writing about wine in the late 70s, there was a suspicion outside Europe, maybe even outside France, that terroir was a specifically French concept. But of course, as every gardener knows, even the smallest garden has variations between different corners of it in how well plants thrive and that sort of thing. And the geographical influence on growing is a universal phenomenon.
It is. And I think it's also related to food. You see an increasing interest in where our food is grown, its provenance.
And the, I suppose the wine equivalent of that has been the massive shift from an obsession with a handful of international grape varieties, so-called things like Cabernet and Chardonnay, and now people really keen to develop and replant indigenous grape varieties and rediscover them, even old varieties that are so almost extinct they don't have a name. They are encouraging them, making little vinifications from them, planting them up. And it's all, I think it's all very helpful. It's all, and it sort of reflects the trend to rediscover heritage tomato varieties and apples.
In the wine world, it's about recognising that old varieties were best suited to those particular locations, even though the climate has changed.
Yes, absolutely. And just have a very strong local accent. So I think it's all very healthy that there are people have there's much greater variation in the sort of wines you can find nowadays than say in the 1990s.
That's right, and winemaking's changed too. I remember that in the 1990s in northern Italy, Arnaise and Cortese as grape varieties had almost disappeared.
That's right, yes. And now, well, I wrote a book with two other co-authors that came out in 2012 called Wine Grapes, in which we tried to catalogue and profile every single wine grape variety we could find that was producing wine commercially. And we came up then with 1,368. But I bet you if we were to do it today, it would be closer to 1,500 because in countries, especially like Italy, they've really been working hard at rediscovering old varieties.
It's true also in Turkey and in Israel.
And in Greece and Portugal and Spain. I'm a big fan of both Greek and Portuguese wines because they have virtually turned their backs on international varieties and produce wonderful wide range of wines almost exclusively from their own grapes.
That's true. And it gives the wines a particular pleasure to drink.
No, something really, really special.
You're in Australia for a week. What else are you doing while you're here?
I'm as well as launching the brand new 8th World Atlas of Wine, I'm launching my beautiful wine glass, which I never thought I would come up with. But I was approached by a talented young British designer who said he wanted to come up with a wine glass and he needed expert help. And everyone said he had to come and see me. And I thought to myself, well, I hadn't considered doing this, but I have got 40 plus years experience of tasting wine, and I've got a very strong opinion about the ideal glass. And my thought is that there is absolutely no need for all these different sorts and shapes and sizes of wine glasses. The process of tasting is really very similar for whatever the wine, whether it's sparkling or strong or white or red. And so I've come up with one beautiful glass, which is being distributed in Australia by a Melbourne wine importer, Cellarhand. So we go to fine wine importers because this is a wine drinker's glass.
Cellarhand, I know. What's the shape of the glass?
I suppose you'd call it a giant tulip. It's the sort of classic shape of broad at the bottom and smaller at the top. But it's very, very fine glass. It is mouth-blown. And by hand, so each one is very, very, very slightly different. But, you know, it's that gorgeous feeling as though you're at one with the wine because you haven't got this great big heavy lip. But it is dishwasher proof, which is, in my book, absolutely essential because I don't think polishing glasses is a fun way to spend time.
No, it's not, particularly when you have a large group of friends around the table.
And that's when glasses get broken. Is when you're polishing them by hand.
I can't wait to see it or drink from it, and it would be nice to have a single glass.
In line with this sort of decluttering philosophy of the moment, you know, we don't all have infinite shelf space, and it does make life much simpler if you just got one, and then if you break one, then you just need one more. You don't have to buy a whole new set, you know, worry about breaking a set. And the other thing I'm doing, which I should mention, is I'm participating in the Yarra Valley have a Chardonnay symposium on Thursday, and they're getting together a whole load of people and Chardonnays, and we're going to talk Chardonnay in the Yarra.
The Yarra Valley, to my taste, produced some particularly fine Chardonnays.
Well, I think that's they're staking their flag in the ground with that one. And I'm a great fan of Australian Chardonnay anyway. I think it is much, much more consistent now and accessible than white Burgundy. And it's certainly a whole lot better priced. And I'm always recommending that French people should try more Australian Chardonnays, particularly since it seems as though a lot of good Australian Chardonnay producers have got over the sort of what you might call the anorexic stage. I think, you know, it went from the big fat gnocchi to too thin at one stage. But now, more or less, the balance is about right.
I think that's right. I mean, there was a stage when everyone wanted riper and woodier, and then it went terribly lean, and you weren't at all sure what grape variety you were drinking. Do you come to Australia often?
Perhaps about every 2 years. Yes, approximately, I'd say, yes. And I have a great friend here in Sydney that I shared a flat with at Oxford. And I always say that my two best friends from Oxford, one lives in Sydney and one lives in Oxford, and I see the one in Sydney more often than the one in Oxford.
That's funny. Getting back to the World Atlas of Wine, this is an odd question to ask. There were 7 years, I think, between the 7th and 8th editions. Is the change of pace, the changes so rapid in climate and style, that you think it will be another 7 years, or perhaps 5? Sorry.
Not good timing for that question. Please give me a break, I think. It's such a lot of work involved with it. You know, this was 2 solid years of work on updating the 7th edition to produce the 8th that I really can't bear to think of undertaking it again.
No, don't think of it, because I shall say that I think this new edition reflects quite extraordinarily the changes that are occurring both in styles and in climate.
I had to completely rewrite the introductory pages and allocate for the first time 2 pages to the changing climate. We've added a lot of new infographics, for instance. So there's one that shows the dramatic change in advance in harvest dates. We chose Châteauneuf-du-Pape, but we could probably have chosen almost anywhere. And nowadays, grapes are picked a full month earlier than they used to be, for instance. All sorts of challenges for vine growers all over the world. But of course, there are some beneficiaries, such as in the far north of Europe, where, for instance, Germany can ripen grapes reliably every single year. And this summer, there were even some sunburnt grapes in Germany, which, you know, would have been unthinkable in the 70s and 80s.
Entirely. For us, I think, the moral is that we should keep drinking, enjoying, and we should keep reading about wine.
Couldn't agree more.
Jancis Robinson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Travel Writers Show on JAIR 87.8 FM.